Light started to fail. The air war, dormant all day, was beginning to come alive once more. The Vox was reporting a mass daytime air raid on Croton, and Augur systems had picked up more waves bound for the skies above Ridge 1. The day before, the Greenskins had focused their aircraft on one target and then the other. Today, it seemed as though they were using their vast numerical superiority to strike at both with simultaneous, equal force. Castor suspected there was nothing Flight Marshal Roggins could do but deploy a few token wings to contest them. One of those wings flew cover with the Thunderhawk Dromedas. Its pilot, Brother Quilo, took it hard and low for 60 miles south of Ridge 1, arcing slowly westwards as they swung wide around Shebat Alpha's southernmost remains. The Thunderbolts, sent to chaperone the Ultramarine's flyer, stood off, maintaining an operational altitude ceiling in order to avoid drawing attention to their charge. As evening drew in, a flight of green-skin heavy bombers were spotted heading northwards. For a while, it looked as if their fighter support was going to sweep away from the raggedy formation and give chase. Whatever beast commanded the wing, however, clearly knew better than to allow its escorts to leave the bombers exposed. After a brief detour, the greenskin fighters rejoined their heavier cousins, and the Thunderbolts resumed their southwestward course, roaring far above the rattling Thunderhawk. Castor sat within Dromedus's hold, strapped to one of the restraint benches. His helmet was maglocked to his belt, revealing the features he shared so closely with his blood brother. The golden hair, firm jawline, and soft, discerning eyes. Those eyes were on the other occupants of the transport as it jutted through a fresh patch of turbulence. There were three of them, Primaris Ultramarines seated across from the chaplain. They wore the customized, form-fitting power armor and death's head masks of the Reavers, and their own bowed heads and silence mirrored that of the chaplain. Castor contemplated them without speaking, knowing they were all aware of his gaze. Severus himself sat opposite Castor, flanked by his two death brothers. Their names were Phobos and Strix. All three had removed their helms, though the skull masks remained in place, obscuring their lower faces. Not for the first time, the chaplain pondered the similarities between his own office and those who followed the path of the Reaver. Some called them a cult. It was a false accusation. Castor had examined the beliefs of each one of the Fulminata's death brethren in detail over many decades. Their actions and attitudes set them apart. Castor could understand how their fellow Ultramarines, especially non-Primaris, found them a strange and potentially dangerous addition to the chapter. They were taciturn in the extreme, and when they did interact with their battle brothers, they usually displayed either a high degree of morbidity or a vicious, bloodthirsty streak that seemed far removed from the balance espoused by the Codex. Their mode of warfare required them to be ruthless, efficient, and when necessary, uncompromisingly brutal. Such attributes were far from uncommon among the Adeptus Astartes, but among the Reavers they were amplified, sharpened to an edge as wicked as the long blades they wielded with such chilling ability. Severus exemplified them, taciturn at best, with the grace and poise of a hunting larynx. His every move was considered, his every pronouncement precise. Where Castor's eyes were a soft blue approaching grey, the Reavers were like ice, cold and unyielding. His shaved head was crisscrossed with ridges of thick white scar tissue, and Castor could count on one hand the number of times he had encountered him without the skeletal leer of his skull mask fixed in place. His grim demeanour would likely have seen him treated as an outcast by the Brotherhood, were it not for the fact that there was barely a single member of the Fulminata who did not owe their lives to the intervention of his Reavers at some point or another. No other squad came close to their kill tallies, and even the likes of Lieutenant Samson would have thought twice before coming between them and their designated kill target. Demeter used to describe them as his hunting hounds. Give them the scent, and they would not stop until their quarry had been tracked down and brought to heel. The Reaver Sergeant's eyes had been fixed unblinkingly on the Thunderhawk's deck, but they rose abruptly, meeting Castor's. The chaplain found himself recalling the cold, predatory gaze of the crophound that had come for the grox herd he'd been watching over one night, the memory dredged abruptly from his youth. He'd known that to break contact with the starved animal would mean instant death, Yet the urge had been overwhelming. He'd hesitated, standing his ground, torch in hand, the groks behind him lowing in distress as they caught the predator's scent. He decided later on that the encounter had surely lasted only seconds, and yet it had felt like so much longer, his young heart hammering in his chest, his skinny limbs trembling, breath held, as though to even emit it would be to risk the savagery of claws and fangs. Polixis had saved him that night. The older boy had come running with another torch in hand, shouting at the top of his lungs. The beast had taken fright and loped back off into the darkness. But Polixis wasn't here any more. Severus looked away, turning his eyes to the deck again. Castor realized he'd been holding his breath.
1 hour out, brethren, the voice of the pilot, Quilo, crackled over the intercom.
Castor forced himself to take his eyes off the Reavers and glance at the locator orspecs wired above the hull's disembarkation ramp. It showed their latest fixing, just east of the tombstones and south of Shabbat. Ostensibly the plan was simple. Insertion into the mountains around the city, followed by infiltration into its ruined heart. Whatever purpose Polixis had been taken for, it was almost certain the warlord of the Wah would demand such a potent trophy. Finding Urgork would lead to finding Polixis, and discovering the location of a greenskin leader was rarely a difficult process. That was what he had impressed on Severus when he had caught the Reaver's reticence at allowing the chaplain to join his brethren. The hard part would be living long enough to get Polixis out. Severus had run over the operation with Castor immediately after takeoff. He had spoken only briefly to the chaplain when he had first arrived, jogging through the swirling ash cloud just as the three Reavers were climbing the Thunderhawk's rear ramp.
"If you are to accompany us, brother chaplain, you will follow my directives to the letter," he had said.
Castor had sworn he would do so. No questions about his inclusion were asked. Castor had no doubt the Reaver was aware Tyrannus had not approved his place in the mission. Nor, however, had the lieutenant specifically forbade him from going. There had been neither binding oaths nor orders. Had he been a part of the Demi-Company's direct command structure, there was no doubt he would have been forced to remain on the ridge, but his position as chaplain afforded him the autonomy he needed. Those were the conclusions he had drawn during the afternoon's meditations. Had Captain Demeter ordered him to stay, he would have stayed. As it stood, though, only the strictest reading of the Codex would have indicated that he had no other option than to follow Lieutenant Tyrannus's directives and remain on the ridge. The letter was clear. The moral was not. Did the Brotherhood still need him, and would a renewed greenskin assault right now push them beyond breaking point? He doubted it. The truth was, he had been at peace the moment he had stepped down from the wreckage of the Orc fighter's fuselage. He was going to find his brother, or he was going to die trying. If there were any consequences, he would face them unflinchingly when he returned.
"You are concerned, brother chaplain," said Severus over the sound of Dromedus's engines.
Castor realized he was looking at him once more.
"Is that why you so rarely remove your mask, Sergeant?" he replied. "So no one can discern your true feelings?" "The masks are not for our benefit, but for those we hunt," Severus said, humorlessly. "We are their death made manifest. Regardless of whether they fight or flee, we will come for them. They must be made to understand that." "Two covers of the same book," Castor said, looking down at his own skull helm, locked to his hip. "I am a reminder of mankind's mortality, the revelation that all shall stand before the Emperor and be judged, vengefully if need be. You bring that same lesson to mankind's enemies." "We do," Severus said, his eyes still on the chaplain.
They had conversed before about the particular beliefs of the Reavers and their place within the chapter. Even the hardliners had accepted that the Codex Astartes supported their mode of warfare. Covert infiltration and brutal shock tactics were already at the heart of many Space Marine combat doctrines. It was the Reavers' more unconventional trappings that had caused concern outside their brotherhood. The skull masks and the morbidity, the closed nature of their squads, and the rumours of blood rites and cult-like inductions. Castor knew such stories for what they were, unsound gossip, and was sure to stamp them out wherever and whenever they reared up in the sparring blocks or barrack dorms. Appearances aside, the Reavers were no death cult. Perhaps Castor's respect for their insular aspects was part of the reason Severus hadn't refused him. Or perhaps he understood better than anyone else in the Fulminata the terrible urges that took hold when a brother fell or was captured. Perhaps that was why he hadn't questioned him when he had appeared from the ash with a look as cold as his own in those pale eyes. Polixis. Polixis slept the half-sleep of the Adeptus Astartes, his thoughts sluggish and distant. The catalepsian node, the sixth of the glands, organs, and nodes that made a space marine, allowed its bearer to enter a meditative state when regular sleep was not an option. Parts of the brain were rested in turn, allowing Polixis to maintain a degree of consciousness and readiness. Without it, he would not have been able to sleep at all. The urge to continue his attempts at escape had only increased as Urgork had left him and darkness had descended on the basilica. It had to have been days since he had last slept, and while a Primaris was more than capable of remaining combat effective for long periods at a time, Polixis understood better than most the importance of rest. The pain of torture and the mental and physical strain of his unique form of imprisonment had worn him down. He was resistant to hardship, but not immune. The cold, clinical part of his mind told him as much, even as the rest of his thoughts continued to burn with anger he was sure his younger brother would have approved of. The mere fact that the Xenos thought it could use him to its own ends was enough of an affront, even before he considered the defilement of the basilica around him. He did not need Castor's battle rites to feel an unaccustomed surge in his hatred for the enemies of mankind whenever he came across their blasphemies against the imperial creed. Perhaps it was simply his brother's nature finally rubbing off on him.
"You taught me more than you know, little brother," he growled.
Eventually, he was able to quell his thoughts and reassert his detachment enough to find a degree of rest. Around him, the basilica had largely fallen silent. It seemed even the greenskins needed time to recover from their near-constant scrapping. Dozens lay sprawled across the bare stone floor, most of them intoxicated by the vile-smelling fungal brew they seemed to imbibe so much of. Even the squig beasts were unconscious, rocking gently on their backs, their warty tongues lolling from open maws, and stubby, upturned limbs twitching the air. Where Urgork had gone, Polixis didn't know. His altar throne was now vacant. The apothecary had last seen the deformed greenskin limping down into the basilica's undercroft, accompanied by his gaggle of flunkies and minions. Presumably the orcs had already discovered the munitions abandoned in the crypts beneath, left behind by the guard during their hasty evacuation. Polixis didn't doubt the shells were already being lobbed back at the artillery pieces they had been forged for, all along Ridge One. He could hear the distant rumble of the guns on the heavy night air. In his own absence, Urgork had left the greenskins that had first captured Polixis to guard him through the night, surely as much from their fellow orcs as to stop any escape attempt. The apothecary had encountered their kind before, albeit on only a few occasions. They seemed to style themselves after the covert units of the Astra Militarum and Tempestus Scions, engaged in crude and basic sabotage, assassination, and the penetration of rear-line cohorts. While their raggedy capes and rugged night-vision goggles could appear incongruous, Polixis had witnessed their work first-hand. The ambush in the Carsin Delta on Myra III, and the great hunt through the Solek jungles. They could be extremely deadly. They were a reminder that while Imperial propaganda worked tirelessly to portray the Green Menace as crude, oafish, and savage, such a view was disingenuous. The orcs could not have infested vast swathes of the galaxy with their brutish spore without being highly adaptable and cunning. That was something too many good soldiers of the Imperium, officers and men alike, had discovered to their cost. Polixus realized he too had made the same mistake. He had allowed himself to be drawn into the fury of the breach assault during the battle on the ridge, and had become snared. That the Orc commandos appeared to have been sent specifically for him was an even more disturbing revelation. Urgork still hadn't described exactly what he wanted from the Primaris, seemingly content to let the question prey on him during the long, dark hours. While Polixis could conceive of nothing he feared that would break him, either mentally or physically, every moment he remained in captivity created a further moment of risk. What if the Xenos used him to draw in the Fulminata, or tried to bargain with the likes of Field Marshal Kloss? How many men might be lost if he was utilized as bait? What was worse, how would Castor react? He had no doubt his brother believed he was still alive. Had Tyrannus managed to convince him not to embark on a rescue attempt? Would his rage allow him to pause long enough to reflect on the madness of risking his own life in some hopeless effort, now that the chaplain's leadership and guidance was needed by the Fulminata more than ever before? From the sounds of the distant artillery, it seemed as though another offensive was already underway. Were his battle brothers even now fighting against the onrushing green tide, suffering their blows without their apothecary at hand to aid them?
"Guide my blood brother," Polixis muttered,
reaching out once more to the Emperor and the Primarch.
"For the sake of the chapter, don't let him do anything foolish."
The thought of Castor engaged in an effort to save him made Polixis's captivity intolerable. He had to try to get out, but escape was impossible if he was immobilized. As time elapsed, he drifted in and out of his subconscious, allowing his catalepsian node to engage and fade out his bleak surroundings. How long he remained in a fugue state was difficult to tell. With his auto-sensors offline and his helmet gone, he had no access to a chronometer, and the darkness within the basilica remained near complete, lit only by a few red embers amidst the piles of trash and broken pews the orcs had been roasting their food over. At some point, motion disturbed his languished thoughts, triggering a gland impulse that returned him immediately to full consciousness. His guards had drifted off to sleep, but there was one greenskin in the defiled basilica still awake. The greenskin medic was back. The creature was still clad in its dirty hospital garb, the plastic material of its black gloves crackling slightly as it moved up onto the app's dais. It took a while for Polixis to realize what it was doing. He watched with growing surprise as it moved from one sleeping greenskin to the next, one of its grubby syringes in a gloved hand. With a care rare in such beasts, it injected each of the six orcs sprawled about Urgork's throne and Polixis's rack, its ugly face a focused rictus of concentration. Only when the final dose had been administered did it place the syringe carefully back into its satchel and approach the Primaris. Polixis looked down at the hunched creature, but said nothing. Wordlessly, it reached up with its gloved hands and ran them along first his breastplate and then his outstretched left arm, the plastic squeaking slightly as it dragged over the ceramite's white surface. The thing's fingers came to rest on the bulky apparatus of his Narthesium, still attached to his left gauntlet. It stood on its tiptoes, squinting as it inspected the device in the near darkness, its claws probing the wicked edges of the chainsaw, the drill bit spike, and the blank screen of the diagnostic panel. Last of all, it touched the cryovials at the rear of the device. It paused, and something approximating a smile split its tusked maw.
"Them lads won't be waking up any time soon," it hissed,
one hand still on the Narthesium as it gestured with its other back towards the guards lying unmoving across the apse.
"Thought I'd come visit you. Compare notes, one doc to another."
Polixis didn't reply. The thing's smile became an angry grimace. It slid a thick, rusting saw blade free from the pockets stitched into its surgical gown, and placed one boot on Polixis's left knee guard, gripping his right pauldron and using it as a brace to drag itself up to eye level. Its stinking breath engulfed the apothecary, and its mad little eyes were suddenly just inches away.
"You ain't gonna be quiet with me, Humie," it snarled.
The orc pressed its rusting saw against the bare flesh of Polixus's throat, just above his broken gorget seal. The Space Marine didn't flinch. He met the greenskin's ugly, squinting gaze as it began to force the jagged metal against his trachea, letting out a grunt of effort as it did so. It had clearly never encountered the dura-metallic coil cables that lent Primaris a layer of subdermal resilience. Its expression became one of confusion, and then anger, as the vicious edge of its misappropriated surgical tool only succeeded in drawing the most slender line of blood from the apothecary's bared throat. The greenskin clearly considered putting the weight of both its hands behind the blade, before thinking better of the danger of losing its grip on his armor. Instead, it drew the saw back, glaring, and spoke again.
"What's the point of you, Humie Docks? You saved the runty ones. You don't even stitch 'em up with new body bits. Some of the boys you saved don't even fight no more after. Why save 'em if they can't fight?"
"Saving the life of a servant of the Emperor is a goal, regardless of whether or not they can still fight," Polixus said, the disgust he felt at the mere presence of the creature forcing the words from his lips. "We are not enslaved to war like you. You are a disgusting breed of beasts, and your concept of healing reflects that."
"So, you saying you got something better to be doing than cramping?"
the doc sneered, baring its small pointy tusks in an approximation of amusement.
"I ain't never heard of beaky boys doing anything other than crumping. What, do you herd squigs when you ain't scrapping?"
Polixus ignored the creature's crude mockery. The smile melted once more from the greenskin's face, its manic mood oscillating dangerously.
"The big boss is well pleased Grimtooth and his git snatched you. He's been looking for one of yous for a long time. I blame that pophead sly boy for it. He's the one that got all them ideas into the big boss's head, telling him the white beakies would fix him all up. That git, he don't need no fixing. I made him, and he's perfect as is."
The orc's voice had risen steadily through the diatribe. One of the unconscious guards sprawled next to the rack twitched and grunted. The medicae froze, still gripping onto Polixus. After a few seconds of silence, it grinned its vile grin once more, speaking again in a sibilant whisper.
"That's why I've been making sure old Sly has been taking his medicine good and proper. Give it another few weeks, and he'll be spewing his guts out. Then we'll see how good his visions are for the boss."
The orc let out a sickly little giggle, the gloved claws of its right hand scraping Polixus's pauldron as it gripped him tighter.
"Your warlord is a freak experiment," Polixus said. "Does it not anger you that your own mad creation is now your master?"
The orc returned its saw blade to Polixus's throat so suddenly it almost lost its grip on his armor.
"You don't speak about that big boss like that,"
it hissed.
"He's the greatest warlord what ever existed."
"And also dying," Polixus added. "Your insane surgeries may have given him life, but how much longer does he have? How much longer before your injections rot his insides?"
"You don't know nothing,"
the orc snarled.
"The big boss has got it in his head that you's gotta fix him up, but he don't need fixing. You understand? You's not gonna say anything to him. I'm his doc, not you."
"Even by the standards of your race, you are a weak and pathetic creature," Polixus said slowly.
"We'll see who's weak after the boss is done with you,"
the orc hissed back, withdrawing its impotent saw blade once more. It dropped back down to the floor and tapped the rusting tool against Polixus's breastplate.
"Remember what I said, Beaky. You don't tell the big boss nothing. If you does, I'll be back when the boys is all asleep again, and we'll see how tough your skin really is."
Chapter 8. The Tombstones. Castor. When they were 3 minutes to the drop zone, Severus slapped his gauntlet against Castor's left pauldron, confirming his glider was ready. Castor had replaced his backpack with one provided by the Reavers during the flight, as dawn had broken out across the wasteland below. Its slightly greater bulk felt cumbersome, and the rest of his armor still had not accepted it as its new power source. The supply reading kept blinking on and off, and occasionally a system overheat warning would appear on the overlay and remain frozen until Castor blink deleted it. He would make the necessary apologies to his blessed armor later. The pack was required because it incorporated the grav glider fins utilized by the Reavers for silent aerial insertions. He had also removed his robes and vestments, folding and locking them in the little reliquary clamped to the small of his back beneath his backpack. They would only be an encumbrance, both during the aerial drop and in the covert operation to follow. Both the glider backpack and the vestments were points Castor had conceded to Severus before takeoff. The operation would be conducted just as the taciturn sergeant had originally planned, and the chaplain's inclusion in Task Force Marillus would not change that.
30 seconds, crackled the voice of the pilot.
Strix hauled back the Thunderhawk's side hatch, exposing the world scudding past below. The featureless expanse of the ash wastes had given way first to the arid foothills of the tombstones, then the rocky slopes and gullies of the great mountain range itself. The drop zone chosen by Severus was deep in the heart of the mountain range, far from the prying eyes of Xenos patrols or air cover. It would allow them to initially traverse the easier routes along the valley bottoms and sparse waterways that wound between the peaks, before approaching the edge of the city itself under the cover of darkness, just east of the Gorgon's winding, toxic expanse.
"Drop zone reached! Green light!"
the pilot's voice clicked. Phobos was first out, stepping into space without hesitation. Strix followed, then Castor stepped up. For the briefest moment, he was on the edge, jagged yellow slopes and knife-back ridges whipping past beneath him. Then he went over, his ears filled with the roar of the Thunderhawk's engines, sudden weightlessness tugging at his stomach. He forced his body into a descent pattern position, battling the whipping wind and gravity's angry pull. A quick glance at his chronometer, then he triggered his grav glider. The fins engaged, snapping out and locking. Immediately, his descent was slowed, tugged back as his armor absorbed the shock of the arrested plummet. He looked down, taking a few seconds to assess the drop zone. Phobos and Strix were 100 feet below and peeling off to his left, dots of blue against the ochre backdrop of the tombstone's newly dawned majesty. Directly beneath, the blue waters of a nameless mountain tributary glittered, the ribbon winding away through the lower valleys and gorges until it reached the Gorgon. The earth around it provided a rare dash of green amidst the dusty yellows of the arid mountains. Clusters of shrubs and small trees hugging the thin strip of fertile soil provided by the tributary. The view, as the sun rose, from the jagged peaks set against the low grey sky to the greener earth directly below, was spectacular. Castor didn't pause to savor it. Severus, dropping 100 feet to his right and further up, had marked a stretch of ground close to the riverbank via their shared visor uplink. Castor locked his own viewfinder into the coordinates and used the rudimentary glider stick attached via the backpack to steer his controlled descent towards it. As he dropped, he caught sight of Dromedas banking round, white streamers inscribing an arc in its wake. The pilot signed off over the vox as he headed back east, the thunderbolts having already peeled away to avoid detection. Castor and the Reavers were alone. The ground rushed up with surprising speed. Phobos impacted first with a brutal thud, followed by Strix, both off in the low undergrowth to Castor's left.
For the briefest second, he was worried he would overshoot and come down in the river itself. He pressed hard on the glider stick, speeding his descent as he arched his back and brought himself round to a landing position. He hit the ground near the river bank with far more force than he intended, whipping through the branches of a clutch of low bushes, and then cracking his right foot against the rocky earth. He skittered along, the veins attached to his backpack clacking, until both boots struck true, and his armor was able to give him enough shock absorbance and balance to run the last few yards. He skidded to a halt just before he hit the embankment. The stream before him was swift and clear, fed by springs further up the mountainside, a far cry from the nightmare toxicity of the Great Gorgon, which the waters would eventually join. He turned, his bolt pistol and Crozius unclamped in an instant as the veins of the glider pack automatically folded away. Nothing stirred in the undergrowth around him. He was alone, lost in what felt like a small paradise, far removed from the choking grey wastelands of the plain below, and all the blood and death and muscle-aching, heart-pounding strain of desperate combat. He snapped out of the moment, barely holding back a curse. His half-botched landing had wasted enough time as it was. He locked Salve Imperata and advanced into the undergrowth, following the location markers of the reavers on his display. He found them gathered 100 yards further north, crouched around the fuzzing blue projection of a handheld holo display, laid out in the underbrush between them. Severus looked up as Castor approached, eyes cold as ever above his skull mask.
"Congratulations on your landing, Brother Chaplain," he said.
If the remark was meant humorously, it didn't show in his voice.
"I can't say I recall my last glider insertion," Castor grumbled, kneeling down beside the reavers.
Severus said nothing more to him, pointing instead at the projection.
"Shebat Alpha lies to the north. We should be on the approach routes not long after nightfall, and nearing the outskirts by middle dark. That will greatly assist our infiltration. Reports from the wastes indicate another Xenos assault on the ridge was repelled last night. If another doesn't come this afternoon, then it will tonight. All their focus should be eastwards. We follow the bank of the Gorgon once we pick it up and use it to penetrate as deeply as possible. That means submersion, if necessary. All clear?"
It was. Strix deactivated the projector and folded it away. Wordlessly, they moved out. Polixis. Urgork returned with the dawn. The misshapen greenskin approached Polixis as he rose once more from his half-sleep, the Medicae thing that had come to the apothecary during the night trailing behind. Weak sunlight was filtering in through the basilica's shattered windows, and the orcs filling the place were rousing themselves with bleary grunts and growls. Polixis's guards seemed particularly hard hit. They stirred only sluggishly, unaware of the after-effects of whatever drug had been administered to them the night before. For his own part, Urgork seemed in a fine mood. The beast gave Polixis one of his ugly half-grins as he mounted the app's steps.
"Morning, Doc," he exclaimed. "Hope you slept good and proper. Got plenty of work to be getting on with today."
He stopped in front of the apothecary, fists balled on his hips, looking the Primaris up and down.
"You's probably thinking I'm going to start crumping you right about now," he said,
his tone verging on conciliatory.
"Crack that big white shell open and start sticking you with all this and that. Maybe more glum zapstick again, or cog crusher's big saw. Can't lie to you, Beaky. I'd like to see how much of all that stuff you could take. Maybe later. But for now, we's gonna keep it nice and simple. You tell my doc how to fix me up. If you does, I promise I'll chop you quick and hard when the time comes."
The closest greenskins laughed darkly, clearly aware of their warlord's lies. The Medicae greenskin, hunched over behind Urgork, just glared at Polixis, fingering the handle of one of its saws. You are a monstrosity without any right to life, Polixis said. All the medical science in the galaxy could not extend your existence by a second. Even if it could, I would not tell you of it.
Urgork moved, the motion sudden and violent, the speed belying his deformed body. He snatched Polixis by his hair and slammed his skull back against the rack's frame, snarling in his face.
You still talking tough, Beaky? Time to change that for good. We'll see how tough you really is soon enough.
The orc stepped back and clicked his fingers at a gaggle of minions clustered around his throne. They scrambled to comply, snatching and tugging at the raggedy hides that had been drawn over whatever was heaped at the throne's base. As they were dragged away, Polixis felt his body surge with a fresh dose of adrenaline and stims. His fists clenched, and his face flushed with rage. Before him lay the remains of Squad Tyro, Ancient Skyrus, and Captain Demeter. Their corpses had been dumped around Urgork's throne like so much trash, their proud battle plate rent and bloodied, frozen in their death throes. Demeter held pride of place at the foot of the throne, slumped over, helmet bowed, as though he'd been greeted by the Emperor in his final moments. His right arm was missing, and his ancient power sword, Justicia, lay discarded in the debris and dried blood at his feet. The sight of his brother's defiled corpses enraged Polixis beyond words. He flung himself against his restraints, but still his own armor resisted him, subverted by the unknowable Xenos technology that had killed its machine spirit.
"Guessing you knew these gits," Urgork said, his voice now low and mocking. "They put up a right proper scrap. Well, some of them did. They all squealed in the end, though. Especially this'un."
The warlord aimed a kick at Demeter, causing the body to slump to one side. Polixis redoubled his efforts, snarling. Urgork just laughed.
"This must be yours too, then," he said,
bending down beside Skyrus's remains and tugging at something caught under the battle plate. A long strip of blue and white silk weave emerged as Urgork dragged at it, accompanied by a ripping sound as a section remained trapped beneath the body.
"You humies love your bits of cloth,"
the orc said, holding it up in one fist for Polixis's benefit. The Primaris found himself looking at the white crest of the chapter, just discernible through the blood and dirt that caked it. He realized he was seeing the ragged remains of the Fulminatus standard, now held in the clutches of the filthy alien.
"I will kill you," Polixis said. "I will carve your head from your shoulders and see your body turned to ash." "That's the spirit! We got your big tank, too,"
Urgork said, with casual disdain, pointing towards more hides flung across a great, bulky object that had been hauled through a gap, smashed in the basilica's flank.
"Gonna let my big mech tinker with it. Make it bigger, stronger, faster. The usual. And you's gonna see it all, Beaky. Unless you help me."
"May the Emperor's burning blade take you and all your vile spore."
"Thought you'd say something like that,"
Urgork said, holding a hand out for one of the pain boy's syringes.
"Don't you worry, though, Biggie boy. We's just getting started. Plenty of time to change your mind."
Castor. It would have taken several days' travel for anyone else to approach from the drop zone to within 15 miles of Shabbat's southern edge. It took the Primaris until nightfall. They moved at the double, following the comparatively easy path taken by the stream as it sought out the Gorgon amidst the crevasses and gullies of the tombstone's depths. Their stamina was barely tested, even without the servos of their armor enhancing their speed and poise over the rugged terrain. Their endurance was unmatched. Following such a bloody battle, even a fellow brother of the Adeptus Astartes would have shown a degree of weariness by late afternoon, and would doubtless have benefited from her pause to maintain efficiency and area awareness. The Primaris needed no such respite. The Reavers were accustomed to such pace and distance when tracking quarry, and for his own part, Castor knew such exertions were well within his own limitations. He was far stockier than the physically lithe Reavers, and his armor and its systems were not as optimized towards long-distance movement as theirs, but he adapted his mind to it, knowing, ultimately, that his heavily enhanced body would follow. He sunk part of his thoughts into a recital of the third teaching of the Master of Sanctity, even as he continued to automatically scan the landscape they passed through, constantly aware of the most optimal pathways, potential ambush points, and areas where they could be observed from. All the while he maintained a determined gait, armor whirring, his system stable now that the battle plate seemed to have finally, grudgingly, accepted its new power source. They picked up the Gorgon towards early evening, as the shadows along the peaks lengthened, and the darkness sitting in the valley bottoms deepened. The stream led them down skittering slopes and short, tumbling waterfalls, until their enhanced hearing detected the rushing of the great river, followed soon after by the toxic stink of its pollution. They found it wending its way between two great scree slopes, its sluggish passage hastened only slightly by the inflow of fresh water from the mountain stream. Its banks were scummed with foam and nameless slurry, and vapors rose from patches of its crusted surface like the fumes of a rotting corpse. The slopes either side of it were barren and dry, offering nothing in the way of concealment.
"We take to the ridge line for now,"
Severus said, indicating the nearest crest,
"and follow it north."
The Primaris mounted the rocky slope, spreading out as they went. The elevation afforded them a better view, both of the valleys below and the peaks that still stood between them and Shabbat. Black smoke was visible climbing from the location of the ruined city, a slow, lazy coil set against the red of the dipping sun. They'd been following the Gorgon for an hour when Severus, on point, 50 yards ahead of the others, detected something. It was a sound bouncing along the gorges and crevasses further northwest, the growl of engines. The Auspex confirmed the noise moments later. There was a column of some sort, moving north towards Shabbat, also running parallel with the Gorgon. As they drew closer, more noise became apparent. Raucous shouts and the occasional thudding burst of gunfire.
"Greenskins," Severus voxed. "One valley across. The Auspex is struggling to get a dedicated fix."
"We go around," Phobos replied.
"If they are moving on Shabbat, they will cut across our route, and if they stop for the night, they will have blocked the most direct path. It would require a substantial detour." "If they're coming up from the south, that needs to be confirmed,"
Castor interjected.
"We were unaware of any route through the mountains sufficient to allow Xenos reinforcement of Shabbat from that direction. Lieutenant Tyrannus needs to know if they are reinforcing the city. We should run reconnaissance on them while we have the opportunity."
Severus was silent for a while, crouched along the ridgeline further ahead, and Castor wondered whether he was struggling with anger at the chaplain's interruption. When he spoke again, however, his voice was as emotionless as ever.
"Perhaps. It depends where they stop for the night. There are several lesser approaches to the city they might use. If their choice carries them out of our path, it would be foolish to divert and risk detection. Besides, we are too deep in among the tombstones now to send a message back to the Fulminata. The communications link has been lost. And if the Xenos halt right along our route, then we improvise."
They moved off once more, keeping to the ridgelines as they wound their way north. The sound of the greenskin column receded as the evening wore on, and they drew away from the Primaris, dropping off the edge of the Auspex's rangefinder. The separation didn't last for long. As darkness fell, lights became visible ahead, the flickering red glow of campfires in the valley adjacent to the route they were following. It seemed the greenskins were set to obstruct them after all, whether they knew it or not. Severus called another halt. He scanned their immediate surroundings, as well as the numbers of the orcs ahead. To the east, a mountain peak rose to a wicked tip, now lost in the darkness, a nigh unassailable pinnacle of jagged, dry stone. Westwards, the Gorgons snaked out, bending around another spine-like promontory. Between them lay a series of narrow, small valleys, ripped from Ikara's earth by age-old geological disruption. They would take them either through or directly past the gorge, where the Xenos column had made their camp.
"At this stage, a detour isn't feasible," Severus said. "According to the readings, the encampment ahead isn't large. I estimate between 70 and 100 xenoforms, 12 vehicles, light armor. Infiltrating through their lines offers the best outcome-to-time ratio. Assuming, Chaplain Castor, that you remain at my side at all times." "I swear it," Castor replied, not pausing to question the Reaver's words. Now was no time for churlishness. "If we press on, we will be amongst Shabbat's slum ruins by dawn, probably before the column is on the move again," Severus continued.
"If we're that close to Shabbat, why have the Xenos halted for the night?" Phobos wondered. "If they carried on, they'd reach the outskirts before middle dark."
"Fuel efficiency, breakdowns, superstition," Severus said. "Until we get closer, it is impossible to say. I will move up and conduct reconnaissance. Hold this position until I return."
The Reaver sergeant headed off into the darkness once more, servos silent, disappearing even from Castor's autosensors almost immediately. He waited, scanning the surrounding darkness for anything untoward, feeling his own heightening sense of anticipation. He suppressed it, refusing to savor the possibilities. If Severus was correct about the numbers of the greenskin encampment, then it was entirely possible that 4 Primaris, especially 3 Reavers and a battle chaplain, would be able to wipe them out without sustaining serious injuries. The desire Castor felt to do just that didn't stem solely from the anger still smoldering in his heart. All Adeptus Astartes were shock troopers first and foremost. They disdained camouflage in favor of proud heraldry that declared their presence to friend and foe alike. They preferred the fury of sudden violent assaults and lightning frontal attacks that, had they been conducted by lesser troops, would have seemed like suicidal madness. Only in rare cases, as with the Reavers, did they favor covert undertakings and careful infiltration. Castor focused his mind on the Codex. The blessings of the Emperor were not to be squandered by adherence to a single stifling style of warfare. His only objective was to return his brother to the Fulminata, and at the moment infiltration was by far the optimal strategy. Following Severus's lead and maintaining a low profile was improving his chances of reaching Polixis, and giving in to the natural desire to bring vengeful justice to the nearest Xenos would not help either of them. Severus returned 20 minutes later, materializing as rapidly as he had vanished.
"My original scans were correct. I estimate 80 Xenos and counted 9 trucks. It appears several of them have broken down. They have paused for now, but they may depart at any moment, with or without those engines that have failed." "So, do we wait?" Castor asked. "Or press on? If dawn comes and we remain anywhere near here, we run the real risk of being compromised." "I know," Severus said. "Their security is unusually high. I was forced to eliminate 2 Gretchen just to attain an effective overwatch position. I doubt they will be missed, but the same cannot be said once we start terminating the orcs themselves." "Then let us not concern ourselves with the difficulties of infiltration," Castor said, his anger rising. Every moment they delayed left him feeling as though his blood brother were slipping further and further away. "You have seen them for yourself. They are not numerous. Between us, and with the blessings of the Emperor's wrath, we can slay them all and be underway again within the next 30 minutes. At this point, any other course of action is a waste of time." "Breaking cover this early into an operation is not what the Codex advises," Severus said. "Nevertheless,
It champions flexibility above all else during covert infiltrations, and on this occasion my instincts agree with your bloody nature, Brother Chaplain. With me. The four Primaris advanced through the night to where the knife-backed ridgeline they'd been following turned sharply east, leaving them on the edge of a rocky promontory overlooking the gorge below. Custer mimicked the Reaver's movements, dropping down onto all fours and approaching the gorge's edge in a crouch. He was forced to bite back another curse, this time at the faint whirring made by his power armor's servos, ear-achingly loud compared to the perfect silence of the stealth suits worn by the other three.
"That's far enough,"
Severus cautioned, switching to his mask's internal vox to hide the sound of his voice. Custer raised his head slightly, his visor lighting up with target locks as the encampment below came into view. Severus was right. The greenskins were on alert. Two ramshackle orc trucks had broken down halfway along the gorge and were now in various states of disrepair, greenskin mechanics bellowing at one another as they pulled away wheels and cracked open drive sections. The remaining vehicles in the column had circled in what little space the gorge allowed, and while most of the aliens were now idly scrapping or slumped in their trucks asleep, a few were manning their pintle weapons and peering out into the darkness. Headlights and the flames of a few delusory campfires lit up the rocky space, and Custer realized that there were Gretchen up on the gorge flanks with them, further left and right. None had yet noticed the Ultramarines, almost in their midst, but it would only be a matter of time.
"We shall have to be fast," Severus voxed. "Moving into their lines before striking will be impossible, and we lack the ranged weaponry to begin the assault from the gorge's flanks. Speed and fury shall be our watchwords." "We are the bane of the Xenos," Custer said, "so let us strike them from above. The space between the edge of the gorge and the bottom should be sufficient to allow our gravgliders to engage."
Severus looked towards the point where the cliff above the greenskins was at its highest, assessing their chances. He nodded.
"I believe you are correct, Brother Chaplain. Such an attack would be unorthodox, but it would dramatically reduce the time we were exposed to Xenos fire. It seems we've already got you thinking like a Reaver." "Anything that speeds this up," Castor said, unlocking his Crozius and bolt pistol. "I will take point," Severus said. "After I've eliminated the Gretchen guarding this side of the gorge, hold position along its edge. We strike together."
They moved, keeping back from the edge of the cliff face. Custer, third in line behind Strix, didn't see Severus bring down the diminutive greenskins watching over the camp below, but his hearing detected the clicking sound of a flurry of silenced bolt pistol shots.
"Stay low," murmured the Reaver.
Custer brought himself once more to the edge of the gorge, the sound of ceramite grating on dirt and stone unbearably loud. He could sense Severus's silent displeasure, and the unwanted attention served to stoke his rage even further. He was the battle chaplain of the Fulminata, not some sneaking assassin. He forced himself to take a breath and calm his thoughts, focusing on the greenskins below. His anger would find a home soon enough.
"On my mark," Severus breathed, his long knife whispering from its sheath. "Hold," Phobos said, his voice cutting through the tension. "The Auspex is picking up fresh readings."
Severus consulted his own display, wired to his left vambrace. Castor's grip around Salve Imperata tightened fractionally. The desire to release the after-effects of the battle stims and combat adrenaline was almost overwhelming.
"Closing from the east and west," Severus confirmed. "Skirmish formation. They're less than 100 paces from our position. Stay prone."
The Reaver had barely issued the instruction before Castor became aware of figures moving in the darkness out beyond the gorge edge. They were hunched over and furtive, and his night vision picked up heavy wasteland capes drawn close, ash goggles, and the outline of autoguns and las rifles.
"Don't move," Severus murmured,
apparently sensing Castor's tension. The four Primaris remained pressed to the ground on the edge of the gorge, as across from them the new arrivals, over 50 in number, dropped to their bellies and began to crawl forwards to its edge. Below, the greenskins remained oblivious, the rock space resounding with the clang of wrenches and the angry bark and growl of squabbling Xenos. Castor looked from the unsuspecting aliens back towards the figures, definitely human, who were silently taking up firing positions above them.
"We do not compromise our cover," Severus said over the vox. "No matter what happens, you wait for my orders, Chaplain."
Castor didn't reply. He could see a heavily robed figure crouched barely 24 paces to his left, priming a clutch of stick grenades. Another was carefully setting up a heavy stubber bipod on a flat rock directly above the 2 broken trucks at the center of the greenskin encampment.
"They're about to discover the Gretchen," Strix said, meaning the diminutive Xenos guard Severus had silently terminated.
"When they open fire, we move back from the gorge edge, fast and silent," the sergeant replied. "While they're focused on the greenskins, we head for the adjacent valley floor and carry on north. Understood?"
"No," Castor said. "These men are about to attack the Xenos filth. I will not abandon them. An Adeptus Astartes never allows another man to fight his battles for him."
"There are no Imperial forces currently operating in the tombstones," Severus hissed. "They could be anyone. Waste nomads, deserters, renegades. Our only certainty is that they are not operating alongside us. If they have abandoned their faith in the Emperor, then they will recant soon enough," Castor growled. "And you will waste precious time ensuring that. If you have prayed recently, I suggest these men are your answer. Their assault will provide the perfect opportunity for us to carry on north without breaking our own cover. The faster we reach Shabbat, the faster we reach your blood, brother. Remember why you are here, Chaplain Castor. Remember the blood of Ajax."
As though to punctuate the Reaver's words, a detonation tore through the gorge below, its thunderclap rebounding from the cliff faces and juddering through the stones beneath Castor. The human attacker had thrown his stick grenade bundle. The night lit up. Lasbolts and hard rounds rained down like a sudden hailstorm on the greenskin camp, blazing from both sides of the gorge. Castor saw dozens of Xenos go down within seconds, twitching back and forth as they were struck from multiple angles, riddled with bullets and las. Others dived for cover within or beneath their vehicles, or snatched up sluggers and shooters, blazing away into the night.
"Move!"
Severus ordered tersely, already backing away from the edge of the gorge. Castor forced himself to follow, teeth gritted. To be denied righteous combat was one thing, but to actively avoid it when men were risking their lives to put down Xenos filth was nigh unbearable. He sought out the words of the Catechism of Limitation as he moved after Severus, keeping low, the sounds of power armor crunching off dry stone and grit lost in the sudden thunder of the ambush. None of the Primaris made it far. Castor had barely gone 12 yards before he picked up a voice over the sounds of the firefight, detected by his lyman's ear.
"Contact! Right! By the cliff edge!"
"They've seen us," he said,
just before the first lasbolt cracked into a boulder 6 yards to his left, scorching a black mark in the yellow stone. More shots followed, las and hard rounds both, snapping at the earth around the Primaris. In the darkness, it was impossible to say whether the humans had mistaken their bulky forms for orcs, or whether they truly were renegades. Regardless, it could only be a matter of seconds before they began priming grenades, or worse, before Severus and his death brethren began shooting back.
"Enough!"
Castor barked. He stood. Shots filled the air around him, striking and sparking from his black battle plate. He ignored them. In one fist, he raised Salve Imperator and activated it. With a crack of discharged power, lightning wreathed the skull-tipped mace and illuminated the Primaris, towering in all his grim, power-armored might.
"In the name of the immortal Emperor of Mankind, cease fire!"
His words boomed out, amplified by his vox vocalizer, resounding over the reports of gunfire and the crack of ricochets. The shooting stopped almost immediately.
"Stop firing!"
he heard one man screaming.
"For throne's sake, cease fire!" "Soldiers of the Emperor!"
Custer intoned, lowering Salve Imperata so it pointed towards the gorge.
Strike them down!
Chapter 9. Anthropophagite. Polixis. The beast left Polixis to struggle for much of the day, the corpses of his battle brothers laid out before him. Only with the onset of night did it summon more of its minions, among them a clanking greenskin that seemed to be composed of crude rusting bionics more than green flesh. The thing was lugging a heavy industrial saw in its wake, and attended by a train of hook-nosed Gretchen hefting spanners and other work tools.
"This is my big mech," Urgork said to Polixis.
He'd witnessed the warlord take 3 injections from its medicae throughout the day, each time apparently reliant on the foul concoction to arrest the seizures that would intermittently grip it. A part of the apothecary felt a morbid sense of fascination towards the unnatural alien and his apparently numerous afflictions. There was no medical precedent for the existence of such a freak experiment, and yet here it was, seemingly kept alive as much by its own schizophrenic willpower as by the dark potions of its creator.
"Cogcrusher here likes all your beaky gubbins," Urgork was saying, indicating to the greenskin mechanic that was peering at Polixis from behind grubby bionic lenses. "All them armor bits and dacker, and especially your big truck. Told him he can't tinker with it all he wants, once I've got you helping me."
Polixis swallowed his retort, knowing it was pointless. The idea that the Xenos wanted to experiment on such blessed armor was as sickening as the thought of them defiling the flesh of the dead Primaris. Urgork waved the thing he'd addressed as Cogcrusher over to the remains of Demeter, Skyrus, and Squad Tyro. The thing's Gretchen slaves scurried and scampered over the fallen Primaris, grimy little hands tugging at armor plates and helmets, squabbling among themselves. Urgork seemed to grow impatient as his mechanic prevaricated over the bodies, apparently overwhelmed by the choices on display.
"Cogcrusher!"
the warlord barked, singling out the body of one of the aggressors, Brother Uxis, with a claw.
"Cut that git open!"
The mechanic hefted its heavy saw, its augmented limbs grating, and the basilica filled with an ear-splitting scream as the wicked blade seared into Brother Uxis's gravis armor. Polixis gritted his teeth so hard that the metallic tang of blood filled his mouth, trying not to think about the brutal defilement of the hallowed battle plate. Trying not to think about what the greenskins were going to do when they finally cracked it open. Fat sparks burst across the flagstones, ceramite, then plasteel, then adamantium giving way with a slow, grim reluctance. It took long minutes to break the will of the gravis plate. The Gretchen scurried about the feet of their mechanical master, tugging away the scraps of twisted blue metal hacked apart by the saw's relentless work. Eventually, Uxis was reduced to his under-armor and black carapace, the greenskins tugging away dermal nodes and connector ports with gleeful, savage abandon. The Ultramarine's dead flesh was left exposed, his breastplate cleft in half, his helmet dragged off, his heraldry split and defiled.
"That's enough!"
Urgork snapped, pointing once more at the body.
"Bring it over here!"
A trio of orcs dragged the heavy corpse and what little remained of its armor before Polixis's rack, grating it over the flagstones. The apothecary found himself looking down into Uxis's dead eyes. Even in death, the slain aggressor appeared stoic, jaw set, expression unwavering. He looked away.
"Squeamish, is ya?"
Urgork demanded, planting a boot on Uxis's torso. The orc's hobnails dug into the pale flesh of the ultramarine's chest. Polixis met the thing's gaze, his eyes burning.
"That's more like it,"
Urgork snarled.
"That's the face of a proper Yumi git looking for a scrap. Never understood why yous get so angry sometimes. Us lads just want a good fight. No point getting all worked up about it. Still,
Here we is. Doc, get over here!
The orc medike scampered to its master's side. It was grinning up at Polixis in its leering manner, clearly delighting in what was about to take place. Polixis felt his anger mount as he began to realize what was happening.
You is about to witness a medical first,
Urgulk said proudly, planting his bald fists on his hips.
Doc Grok here is about to perform the first ever removative surgery on a Humi Beaky in front of another Humi Beaky. Doc, we await your pleasure.
The warlord took his boot off Uxis and stepped away. The medike crouched over the corpse like some sort of hideous carrion creature. After a brief inspection, it laid out a leather strip on the floor, scattered with various rusting blades. The vile parody of the surgeon's fine art turned Polixus's stomach, and he found himself straining once more at his bonds. The servos shuddered slightly, grating, but going no further. None of the greenskins seemed to notice. They were all staring with bated excitement at their hunched-over pain boy. The orc's fingers moved over the instruments of its supposed profession, apparently pondering which one it wanted to employ first. Eventually, it snatched up what appeared to be a small, rusting power saw. The buzz of the cutting tool, like a miniature version of the industrial rotor used by the orc mechanic, filled Polixus's ears.
Stop!
He realized he had barked the word involuntarily. The greenskin medike looked up, clearly startled. Saw still in its hand. Urgulk emitted a hacking laugh that devolved into another bout of coughing. He inhaled noisily and spat before his grin returned.
Can't stop the march of science, Beaky boy. The good doc here has been itching to carve up these gubbins for days now. Wouldn't be right or proper for him or his patients to cancel the operation now. It'd take something big to do that. Say, maybe,
he paused,
you giving me what I want. Tell me your secrets, Beaky. Tell me how I can be free of all this.
The orc jabbed his claw in the direction of the medike's syringe satchel. Polixis stayed silent. Inwardly, he was snarling a string of enraged blasphemies that would have risked a blow from Castor. He damned himself for his own weakness, damned himself for being drawn by Urgulk's defilement. Brother Uxis would not have wanted him to yield, no matter what cruelties were heaped on his corpse. He would not converse with the Xenos, would not justify its existence, even with words of hatred.
Lost your tongue again,
Urgulk grunted, looking disappointed.
Fine, then. Have it your way. Grok!
The smaller greenskin's expression was the opposite of its master's. Smiling manically, it raised its saw blade.
Gonna need this to chop through that thick bone stuff,
the Xenos said, its tone full of relish. It cranked the saw to maximum output and pressed it down against Uxis's bare chest. For a second, the flesh of the Primaris resisted. Then it gave way beneath the buzzing blade, and blood, dark with age, splattered along the saw's edge, hitting the orc's face and stained overalls. The alien licked the blood from its lips, grinning wickedly, but its joyous expression turned to a strained rictus as it put all of its scrawny strength behind the cutting tool, pressing down as it sought to split the Primaris's toughened rib bone. There was a hideous, juddering shriek as rusting metal fought through the breastplate beneath the black carapace, and Polixis thought the saw was going to shatter. Suddenly, there was a sickening crunch. Polixis knew he had just heard Uxis's fused ribs caving in.
Been wondering what makes you Beaky so big and strong,
Urgul growled at Polixis, eyes on the apothecary, while his minion continued to crack the rib cavity open.
And we reckon we's found what it is.
The Medicae Orc let out a yelp of satisfaction and dragged its saw back out of the Space Marine's torso, deactivating the tool as blood and viscera sprayed from it. It swapped it for a flat planing knife, not unlike the two long blades carried by Urgork. As the greenskin began to slice back the aggressor's flesh, it used wicked meat hooks to further widen the chest cavity incision. Polixis realized just what it was doing. It was carving out one of the Space Marine's twin hearts. The Medicae abandoned its blade when most of Uxis's chest had been reduced to raw, flensed muscle. The wound running along his breastbone was now gaping. The orc took up a smaller, hook-tipped knife, clumsily cuffing blood and spittle from its mouth as it crouched over the ultramarine. Polixis tried to put his mind elsewhere, to think about anything other than what was about to happen. Anything to take his mind off the fury that felt as though it were going to burst his own heart and tear his muscles apart. The orc reached into the raw cavity with its knife and began to cut. It was not the sickening, straining work of the bone saw or the cruel slicing of the flensing blade. The little nicks were almost incongruous, but they were the most sacrilegious cuts of all. Eventually, warty tongue jutting from between its tusks in concentration, the greenskin plunged its grubby glove down into the incision. There was a squelching sound before it ripped its hand back out, holding something aloft.
"I got it, boss," it said excitedly to Urgork.
The warlord held out his hand to receive his underling's trophy, before turning to Polixis and holding it up, the dripping, glistening mass of muscle and flesh that was Uxis's primary heart.
"I told you, Beaky, I knows a thing or two about you. We seen how hard you fight to get bits out of your boys when they gets chopped. I knows how much you gits in a white armor want them."
The orc held the torn heart close to Polixis's face, grinning, his yellow eyes full of madness.
"Don't know why you needs it so bad. Don't care, either. All that matters to me is that it matters to you. You know nothing," Polixis snarled. "We's been watching you, lads," the warlord said, his eyes still on Polixis as he turned the grisly organ over in his palm.
The Medicae's crude butchery had only removed part of it.
"Besides, you think you's the first Beaky I've had strapped up here? He wouldn't tell as much at first, but then we hooked old Sly Boy up to his brain. We can do the same to you, but for now, I just want you to know what I know, what I can do."
As the greenskin finished speaking, he clenched his fist. There was a wet squelch, and Urgork opened his hand once again to reveal the crushed remains of the heart spread against his palm.
"The Emperor is with me,"
Polixis began to say, seeking out the words of the rite of intonation, familiar to all Ultramarines apothecaries, in an effort to suppress his fury.
"He is around me and within me, in my words and in my heart, in my deeds and in my sinews."
"Angry git, aren't you?"
Urgork mocked, taking a step closer, so that the orc and the Primaris were only separated by a narrow, charged space.
"Once I gets you going, anyway, it's good to see that sometimes. You and I, Beaky, we ain't so different."
"You are an abomination,"
Polixis spat.
"Big word,"
Urgork said, nodding slowly.
"Abomination! I knows it, though. I've heard it plenty of times before. Other big Yumi words, too. Monstrosity. Aberrance. I understands them, Beaky. It's 'cause I'm different from these other gits."
The beast paused to encompass the rest of the basilica and its greenskin occupiers, speaking as though none of them could hear him.
"I'm bigger and better than them, so they call me things. Even some of the lads used to say things. Freak, dead boy, stitchy skin. Then I crumped them, and they stopped saying those words. I'm bigger and I'm better because I was made to be, and that's how we's the same, Beaky.
You are an insane Xenos monster. We have nothing in common.
You was made to be the best,
Urgul continued, as though Polixis hadn't spoken.
You was put together. You didn't grow like the lads or normal Yumis. You was designed, made to be a boss, like me. That's why I want you, Beaky. That's why you is here. Even more than the smaller Beaky boys. You was made to beat everyone else. I reckon the secret to that is here and here.
The orc pressed a claw against Polixus's breastplate, and then his throat, singling out his progenoids. The space marine shuddered with revulsion, turning his face away from the monster and its hideous gaze.
There is nothing the organs of the Adeptus Astartes can do to preserve your rotting flesh, he said. Cut apart all these bodies, do likewise to me, and you will still be beyond salvation. You were born a monster, and you will die one.
We'll see,
Urgork said slowly. Then, without warning, snatched Polixis by the jaw, yanking his head back round. He tried to resist, but, bound as he was, there was nothing he could do to fight the warlord's nightmarish strength. The orc forced a claw into his mouth, holding his jaw in a vice grip, threatening to crush bone and break his teeth. As Polixis struggled to draw breath while simultaneously biting down on the foul digit, Urgork gripped the torn remains of Uxis's heart in his other hand and rammed it against the Primaris's mouth. Polixis's eyes widened with horror as he realized what was happening. He tried to close his jaw, tried to spit out the alien's filthy fingers, tried to tear them off, but the stinking, unyielding grip of the brutish creature was irresistible. He tasted the coppery tang of blood, followed by a greasy, choking morass.
Gonna take your medicine, Beaky,
Urgork snarled, thick strings of drool dangling from his tusks, his butcher's breath engulfing the apothecary. The flesh of the heart made Polixis heave, but he could not halt its passage, couldn't stop the stifling, horrifying realization of what was happening. It slid thickly down his throat, until it passed the point of no return. He found his breath, and screamed with outrage. But it did no good. Urgork let go and stepped back, allowing Polixis's head to fall. The Primaris remained still, breathing heavily, his mouth full of a foul, greasy aftertaste, his gen-hounced body keeping him from retching.
Tastes good, don't it?
Urgork leered, gesturing for his Medicaid syringe as his body started shaking.
Plenty more where that came from?
Polixis threw his head back and roared. The sound, full of fury and despair, filled the basilica, reverberating from the vaults and cloisters, taking on a life of its own, until it sounded like 100 battle brothers, giving vent to a pain that was beyond words. Even the most raucous greenskins filling the nave and balconies were silenced by the terrible sound, and all stopped and stared at the captive Primaris, some fingering their weapons nervously, others casting glances at the pillars and annexes and the high ceiling, as though expecting to see a host of vengeful warriors materialize at the sound of their brother's agony. But none did. Polixis's cry trailed away to a long, low moan, and the sounds bouncing around the basilica faded, until there was nothing but silence. The Medicaid jabbed its syringe into Urgork's flank. The warlord grunted and went rigid, his eyes never leaving Polixis. The space marine looked up at the beast, held its gaze, his expression one of purest, most unadulterated hatred.
Cog crusher,
Urgork said, as his medicines took effect once more.
Bring the doc here another body.
Castor. The commander's name was Davik. He was a Kelistani colonel, shaven-headed, short and stocky, like most stormers. At some point since the fall of Shabbat, he'd broken his arm. It was bound against his breast by a sling made from a torn-up Numerian camo cape. The injury made making the sign of the Aquila impossible, but he bowed his head reverentially to Castor as best he could.
"My apologies again, Lord," he said. "My men thought you were too large to be anything other than greenskins. The last thing we expected to find out here were the champions of Ultramar."
"In the future, be sure to run through proper target identification drills with your men, Colonel," Castor said.
The chaplain knew his chastening tone was perhaps unjust. They were a ragtag collection of guard outfits, Kelistani, Voitikans, Numerians, a few Faeburn. That their discipline was shaken could hardly be held against them. But Castor was still coming down from an unfulfilled combat high, and that made him acerbic at best. The urge to purge still sang through his veins, battered out by his slowly decelerating heartbeats. He focused his attention on the men before him. When the rock had come down, it had struck the southern end of Shabbat. The forces there had been decimated, but a few units holding the most southerly extent of the slums had avoided annihilation. A scattering of survivors had managed to retreat southwards into the mountains. Davik told the Primaris how he had initially been the second-ranking officer of the ragged group.
"There was a dispute with the Zoyshen colonel yesterday afternoon," Davik said. "He wanted to make a break eastwards for Imperial lines. He thought we could use the trucks we took in the first few ambushes. I told him the trucks would break down, and we'd find ourselves stranded out in the wastes and at the mercy of their damn air cover."
"How many men do you have remaining?" Severus asked the colonel.
He'd been interrogating Davik in the bottom of the gorge when Castor had joined them, absent initially, while he had been blessing the bodies of the three guardsmen killed during the ambush. The colonel glanced from the chaplain to the reaver, clearly uncertain about which of the two skull-faced giants held seniority. Eventually, he addressed Severus.
"Following the latest roll call, 68 combat effective, 11 wounded.
Do you count yourself among that last number, Colonel?"
"A las pistol only takes one hand, Lord."
Castor turned his gaze to the nearest guardsman as Davik spoke. A composite team in the mismatching gear of Voitikan and Numerian infantrymen were heaping the greenskins killed in the ambush, preparing the bodies for torching so as to destroy the spores given off by their corpses. A few kept casting worried glances towards the Primaris, as though afraid the hulking warriors were about to suddenly attack them. They were a weary, demoralized-looking band, caked in dust and dirt. It was not the attitude Castor would have expected from an outfit that had only just conducted a successful ambush against a superior force. Their morale was all but broken.
"This is the third column we've successfully destroyed," Davik was saying, tapping his boot against the thick tire of the orc truck beside him.
"And the third coming up from the south?" Severus asked.
"The south?"
Davik asked, a look of uncertainty crossing his stolid expression.
"These greenskins were coming through the southern passes, from the direction of Baspire?"
"No," Davik said. "No, they've all come from Shabbat. They were turning back. Look."
The colonel moved to the rear of the open truck and dragged away a stained covering. Immediately, the stink of opened innards and the buzzing of hungry, fat-bellied rotwings assailed Castor's auto-sensors. The back of the truck was heaped with the butchered remains of a brace of slope-tuskers and smaller, unidentifiable beasts, their blood congealed in long rivulets towards the trailer's edge.
"They weren't reinforcements," Davik said. "They were a foraging party. They've been coming up into the tombstones ever since they took Shabbat. There isn't enough food for them down there, at least not until their vile spores have taken root."
"Lieutenant Tyrannus must be informed of this," Castor said. "If we can confine the Xenos to the city, we may be able to starve them out." "I will send word to the lieutenant as soon as we are able to establish a connection," Severus said. "In the meantime, I am going to requisition one of these trucks along with its contents."
"Why?"
Davik asked.
I was going to have them burned with their bodies.
Not this one, Severus said, gesturing to the nearest truck with his long blade. I have a use for it. Bring me half a dozen Xenos corpses as well.
To his credit, Davik didn't hesitate, snapping a string of orders to his weary men. Castor could sense his desire to know more, though. As six greenskin bodies were hauled in front of Severus, the colonel spoke.
Lords, with all due respect, may I ask what it is you're doing out here? Are there more of you coming?
Castor looked to Severus, partly disapproving of the man's boldness, partly impressed by his bravery. The Reaver responded.
No, we are conducting a covert operation. We aim to infiltrate Shabbat.
Assassination? Davik wondered aloud. Sabotage?
It is not your place to ask us such things, Severus said. If you are as wise as you are courageous, Colonel, you will hold your tongue.
Of course. I would not presume to question the objectives of the Adeptus Astartes, my lord, but it would be remiss of me not to offer the services of myself and my men. If there is anything we can do to further your mission, just say the word.
Castor expected the usual cold rebuke from the Reaver. Instead, the skull-faced killer nodded.
There is, in fact, some assistance your men may be able to provide me with, Colonel. How much in the way of explosive material were you able to evacuate out of Shabbat?
Screw it. Mektrok's workshop seemed to be getting busier every night. The greenskin mechanic had secured the collapsed remnants of a manufactorum block on the south side of town the day the lads had stormed the Humi city. A new roof of scavenged corrugated iron had been installed, and the rubble had been heaped high enough to give some semblance of structure. Since then, the workshop's floor, cleared of debris by the efforts of Drok's gaggle of Gretchen slaves, had seen lots of fixing and tinkering, and played host to the wheels of over a dozen different speed mobs, all eager to get their battered war machines back into the fight as quickly as possible. Drok was certainly doing better business than either of his two biggest rivals, Mex Fixter and Grug. Cogcrusher himself would have been proud, or so Drok kept insisting. Screwit made an obscene gesture at the mech's back as he rifled through his gubbins, searching for a bigger spanner. The other grots around Screwit snickered with ill-concealed humor, clustered around the engine block of the truck they were supposed to be fixing. Drok spun at the sound, eyes blazing.
"Screw it, you little squig-munch!"
the orc bellowed, lunging for the Gretchen. Screwit yelped and flung himself over the engine, his scrawny frame narrowly avoiding his master's grasping claws. He stumbled down on the other side of the broken-down vehicle, intent on making a run for the workshop's open door. Scrag, of course, stuck a leg out in time to trip him. The Gretchen tumbled over his fellow oiler's limb, a flailing hand snagging Drok's work tarpaulin draped over the engine's flank and hauling a mound of the mech's tools down with him. Scrag's plot didn't go as planned. Most of the rusting pieces of equipment came down directly on top of him, knocking him unconscious. Screwit scrabbled through the dirt as the clang of falling metal resounded in his ears, expecting to feel Drok's claws closing around his skinny throat. They didn't. He realized that, far from the cackles of laughter and excitement that would usually fill the workshop when Drok attempted to snag one of his underlings, a hushed silence had fallen. He stayed on his stomach, hands clasped over his head, eyes screwed shut. Still, neither wrench nor fist fell. He opened one eye. Drok was standing over him, but the mech's eyes weren't on his wayward oiler. The scrap-armored greenskin was staring out of the warehouse entrance towards the foothills of the mountains that loomed over the ruined city. There, just beyond the edge of the broken slums, a great fireball was rising up out of the darkness, its thunderclap detonation, initially masked by the clatter of falling tools, rolling back from the dry, dead hills.
"What that?"
Drok began to say, but a further burst of light out in the darkness stopped him. Flashes of color darted through the night, dozens of little traces quickly swallowed up by the blackness. They were describing a pattern down the hillside towards the city's edge. Another explosion burst into life, nearer this time, its report sounding clear across the ruins away to the edge of the rock's crater. Bellows filled the night as the greenskins nesting in the southern slums began to react to the unexpected activity.
"Humies!"
shouted Krunk, the boss of the truck currently being tinkered with in Drock's workshop. The knob waved his axe in the direction of the light show, which appeared to be steadily descending towards the city.
"Let's go, lads! Scabrot, shut up shop!"
Drock bellowed to his apprentice welder as he snatched up his custom blaster. He jogged out into the night, Screwit's antics apparently forgotten, the grots scrambling to follow him. Screwit managed to get to his feet in time to join them, aiming a vicious kick at the still unconscious Scrag as he went. Outside, the night had descended into chaos. Boys were scrambling in from all sides, hefting choppers and blazing indiscriminately into the darkness with their shooters. Most were headed for the city's outskirts, towards the bolts of light that Screwit now recognized as belonging to the Humies' pew guns. The Gretchen, attending the mobs, knew better than to try to follow their masters. Whatever was going on, it wasn't worth a trampling. Instead, they scampered to the tops of the biggest rubble heaps they could find, craning for a better look at the excitement that was waking up the city. Screwit hiked up his breeches and scrambled to keep up, mounting the rubble of the nearest Hablock's remains, arm over arm. He used his elbows to force his way close to the highest point. Only Fat Chopper and Drock's chief bootlicker, Wrench, remained above him. The perch afforded them a view of the city's southern limits, and the column approaching from out of the darkness. It was one of the food-grubbin' mobs sent up into the hills by the big boss to get more scran for the lads. Screwit recognized the headlights bobbing through the dark, winding a precious route down into the slum ruins. It was obvious, however, that not all the approaching trucks belonged to the grubbers and scran lads anymore. Bolts of light were spraying from the rear of the three speeding transports, shooting towards the two trucks in front, and as they drew nearer, the roar of engines and the crack of gunfire became audible.
"What's going on?"
demanded one of the grots further down the rubble heap, unable to get a good view of the rapidly approaching action. Wrench, eager as ever to be the centre of attention, began to provide a commentary.
"Looks like some Humies have jumped a scran ledge somewhere in the foothills, got hold of one of the mob's trucks, and now they is chasing the other two with it." "One truck of Humies is chasing two trucks of the lads?"
another Gretchen demanded incredulously. Wrench's angry retort was cut out by another explosion, bursting into fiery existence just to the left of one of the fleeing trucks. It looked as though the Humies were lobbing bombs, too.
"They's getting right cramped,"
Chopper squealed excitedly, pointing a claw at the mobs now mobilizing out into the slums. Dozens of trucks and war buggies roared through the rubble, headlights playing over the ruins as they bounced along, greenskins holding on to every surface while bellowing and blazing away with their sidearms. The two scran trucks fleeing from the hills were only a few hundred yards from the safety of the orcs rushing to meet them, searing bolts of energy continuing to perforate the air around them as the Humies kept up their pursuit. As the distance closed, some of the hijackers switched to targeting the oncoming mobs, their energy bolts splitting out to lance buggies and open-topped war tracks. Return fire lit up the night, blazing away inaccurately in all directions.
"They're gonna hit!"
Wrench said excitedly. Screwit craned his neck as the Gretchen around and below him jostled for a better view of the unfolding drama. The two trucks, fleeing from the Humies, shot past the lead vehicles of their rescuers, bouncing along the debris-clogged remnants of the city's streets, while behind, the Humie truck came up short. It took a hard right, and to loud jeers, began to race back towards the looming darkness of the tombstones. The dozens of rickety greenskin vehicles tearing towards them accelerated, their occupants furious that the Humies would consider offering a scrap only to turn tail at the last moment. Chopper grunted, cuffing a smaller Gretchen beneath him around the back of the head.
"The big uns need a scrap, else they'll take it out on us when they gets back."
There was a chorus of groans from the assembled grots as they contemplated orcs left without anything to crump. Screwit was too busy watching the approaching trucks to join in. The two that had come down from the hills hadn't turned at bay when they'd reached the rest of the lads, but had instead carried on into the city, thundering past the mound of rubble being used by the Gretchen. It looked like they'd been hit hard by the Humies. Only two boys were left, one at the steering wheel of each of the vehicles, wrapped up good in the ragged capes and goggles the speed boys used when they were out in the ash wastes. Screwit was only afforded a split-second view as the trucks thundered past, kicking out dirt and rubble from their heavy tires, and then they were gone, careering deeper into the ruined city's heart. The rest of the Gretchen were still watching the ongoing pursuit as the Humies fled back up the hillside and into the darkness. Shots pursued them, and another explosion rocked the night air, catching one of the trucks that had been gaining on the Humies. It tipped it over in a gout of flames, sending it crashing into a war truck that had been pulling up alongside and immolating them both. The Grots let out a loud gasp, followed by a few cheers, as the pyrotechnics continued, touching off another buggy and sending flames licking along the hillside. Despite all the excitement, it looked as though the Humies were getting away.
"You got lucky,"
Screwit heard Wrench saying as he dropped down from the rubble pile.
"Boss Drock was gonna crump you good before all this kicked off. Screwit?"
Screwit didn't respond. He'd noticed something that wasn't right at all. Something that was just beginning to be snooped on. Before the other Gretchen had realized that he was gone, he was heading into the darkness of the city's ruins, in the wake of the two Scran wagons. Grotsnog. Something was happening further south, out in the slums and along the hillsides. Nob Grotsnog had been roused from his sleep beneath the squighide covering that his mob had draped over the ruined alleyway, jerked away by the excited bickering of a gang of nearby Gretchen.
"What's happening?"
he demanded groggily as he rolled out from beneath the hide, scrabbling for his axe. Grolk, the mob's big shooter, was stumbling back down from the nearest mound of rubble, his hulking weapon strapped across his back.
"Humies!"
he bellowed as he came, rousing more of the boys scattered along the alleyway. Most of the mob were out scrapping with Morgoth's lads, angry that their rivals had got closer to the Humie positions on the ridgeline the day before. Those who remained behind were half-intoxicated with fungal beer, but the promise of a real fight got them awake and alert quickly enough.
"What's going on?"
Grotsnog demanded once more, half-snatching, half-catching Grolk as he tumbled down the last few feet of rubble and into the alleyway.
"Humies chasing the Scran lads,"
the big shooter boy panted, pointing a claw southwards.
"Back down from the hills. All the boys down that way is headed out to crump 'em." "Gork's droppings,"
Grotsnog snapped. He could hear the commotion further south, bellowing, the roar of engines and the clatter of gunfire. There were already dozens of mobs, most of them bigger or faster, between them and the south side of the city. Grotsnog had been inordinately pleased with himself when he'd managed to claim the alley close to the big spiky Humie building for his lads early in the occupation, but having a base of operations near the ruined city's heart suddenly didn't seem so smart. Being far from the edges meant far from the fight.
"Don't just stand there,"
the knob bellowed at those around him.
"Get slogging!"
"What about the other lads?"
Dunf demanded.
"It's their loss,"
Grotsnog said, shoving Dunf towards the end of the alleyway.
"Now move it!"
The assorted mob didn't get far, no more than a dozen paces. The mounting howl of an abused engine and the squeal of tires, followed by the shriek of poorly applied brakes, heralded the arrival of a truck careering around the remains of a tumbled-down refinery smokestack. The vehicle made straight for the semi-clear space of the alleyway, forcing Grotsnog and his lads to throw themselves against the rubble on either side to avoid getting flattened by the oncoming truck. Grotsnog's angry protestations were lost in the shriek of a second vehicle as it came screeching around the corner to join the first, black smoke billowing from its exhaust vents.
"Watch where you's driving!"
Grotsnog bellowed, banging the flat of his axe head against the nearest truck's runners as it finally came to a halt beside him. The git driving it was alone, wrapped up good in a scabby dune cape and goggles. Grotsnog recognized the paint job on the truck as belonging to one of the Scran mobs that had been sent up into the hills to help supplement the diet of the hundreds of mobs now assembling in the city.
"Oi, you see the Humies while you was up there?"
he demanded. The driver didn't seem to have heard him, exiting from the other side of the truck's drive compartment. Urzog, on the opposite side of the truck from Grotsnog, made to get out of the big greenskin's way, but tripped and stumbled against the vehicle's chassis. It was only as he hit the dirt that Grotsnog's sluggish brain registered that there was something very, very wrong about the Scran boys. They were big, bigger even than Grotsnog, and none of the lads who'd gone up into the hills had been particularly fine examples of orc might. Even as he realized the disparity, he also realized that blood was jetting from Urzog's severed throat. He hadn't tripped at all. He began to bellow incoherently, reaching for his slugger, at the same time as Dumph dragged back one of the coverings protecting the slaughtered beasts heaped in the back of the first truck. Even as he did so, a body rose up from the bloody remains, its heavy armor smeared with viscera, a mace in one fist lashing out to crack the greenskin's skull open. Grotsnog opened fire. The shattered alleyway resounded with the bark of his pistol, shots spraying inaccurately into the rubble, while around him everything descended into chaos. Grok, slower on the uptake, was struggling to bring his big shooter to bear on the thing that had been driving the first truck. It leapt from the open drive seat straight over the vehicle's bonnet, hideously fast for something so large, a long blade sliding from its ragged cape. Grotsnog was only barely aware of a decapitating blow taking Grolk's head off. He managed just 5 shots before more wicked silver flashed in the firelit darkness. It took him a few seconds to realize why his slugger wasn't firing anymore. By the time it accepted the fact that his severed arm was lying at his feet, fist still clenched around his pistol's grip, a second blow had laid his throat open to the bone. The remains of the mob died quickly, their bellows cut short, their inaccurate gunfire eliminated. Silence fell over the alleyway, sinister and surreal amid the uproarious city. Grotsnog tried to get up, tried to fight, but all he could do was keep his hands clamped around his open throat as he bled to death. He was half aware of one of the murderous giants quickly shattering the headlights of both trucks, bringing darkness to the scene, as the two drivers tugged away their capes and goggles, revealing blue armor and leering skull masks.
"The bodies?" one asked.
"No time," the other replied. "Move."
Castor. The Primaris advanced to the head of the alleyway, low and fast.
"Stay close,"
Severus ordered Castor over the vox. He did so, trying to quell the natural dislike he felt towards infiltration techniques. It had been difficult enough out in the tombstones, surrounded by nothing but the soaring vastness of the mountains, but now that he was in the midst of a city overrun by Xenos scum, the urge to carry righteous death to them was almost overwhelming. He overcame his urges by fixing his mind on the Lectato and its codex-led teachings about the importance of flexibility and adaptability in all of war's many aspects. He was a battle chaplain, not a blind zealot. He had already managed to countenance concealing himself amidst the rancid meat collected by the greenskins in the back of their rickety wagons. Doing so had been a necessary evil, part of Severus's bold plan to infiltrate Shepat under the cover of a distraction led by Colonel Davik. Castor had no idea whether the guardsman in the third commandeered truck had managed to break away from the greenskin pursuit and make it back to the foothills before being caught. Concealed in the wagon's rear, he'd been blind until an orc had pulled back the covering and felt the sudden heat of his wrath.
"There are more contacts closing from the north and northeast," Strix said, consulting the bulky Orspec's primary as they came to the end of the alley.
The other two reavers were crouched behind him, knives sheathed, the crude disguises that had allowed them to race through the orc lines cast off.
"Do they approach with purpose?" Severus demanded.
"No, but they will likely stumble across this location in a matter of minutes."
"And has the device concluded its subterranean scans?"
"Yes, Sergeant. The original locator beacon is correct."
Strix pointed with his own blade beyond the end of the alley, towards the street the trucks had come down.
"Take point," Severus ordered.
They hadn't got far before Castor's visor pinged with a lit-up transmission sigil.
"Vox contact," he said. "We're back in signal range."
"Still no fix, though," Severus replied. "It will take longer for a proper connection to become established. We carry on."
The reavers and the chaplain moved out into the street. The darkness surrounding them was riven with the howling of greenskin mobs and the battering reports of their crude firearms, flares of light illuminating the rubble that towered all around like the great dark barrows of long-dead warrior kings. It seemed that Davik's gambit had been too successful. It felt as though the entire city were awake, the initial disruption spreading from mob to mob all the way to Shebat's heart. They reached the exfiltration point without meeting opposition. It was a sub-street storage hangar, marked out on the powerful Auspex array carried by Strix as having survived the rock's impact. The tremors caused by the collision had not only brought down almost the entirety of the city, it had also split and ruptured Shebat Alpha's underworld, subsurface storage bays, the sewer system, basements, and the subway maglev had all been broken and reformed, and while most of the tunnels had simply collapsed in their entirety, some had remained open. The scans picked up by the Auspex were incomplete, but they offered the best hope of navigating below ground, away from the mobs infesting the surface ruins. Task Force Marilis descended, moving aside the girders and rubble to expose the hangar's entrance. It had once been a vast storage space for a printing business, and its survival was a curious juxtaposition to the devastation of the workshop it had once serviced. Though the lumens had failed, the wide room below remained in an orderly state, packed with sealed plastic containers. A door led to a service corridor, rusting and abandoned, which carried on through to a half-collapsed smelting pit.
"What's the likelihood of the Xenos pursuing us down there?" Castor asked. "There is no evidence that they have accessed the underground," Severus replied. "That may change as we move deeper into the city, but for now it offers us the best chance of avoiding detection, and allows us to scan for the largest concentrations of Xenos without putting ourselves at risk. Wherever they are, that is almost certainly where we will find Helix."
There were two possible routes beyond the smelter pit. One was from a section of the maglev line that had collapsed in on itself, providing access from the adjacent rooms and basements. The other was a waste chute that led to the sewage systems. According to the readings on the Auspex, it was still open at the far end.
"Phobos, take the subway line," Severus ordered. "Strix, the chute. Reconnaissance pattern. Maintain Vox contact if possible. Report back here within the hour. Synchronize your chrono countdown."
"I can accompany one of them," Castor said.
"No need," Severus responded brusquely. "We have to find our bearings and establish just how accurate these readings are before moving any further. They don't need your help to do that."
"So what will I do instead?"
"You will do the same thing as me, Brother Chaplain. You will review the tactical log and mission briefings, and you will wait."
Polixis. The heart had choked his throat. It had made him gag and retch. But the memories were worse. The memories choked his mind. They came on, unbidden, as Polixis remained bound to the rack, a sudden flood stifling in their clarity and overwhelming in their intensity. He was going to die. They all were. Still, on they fought. Uxis's flamestorm gauntlets had nearly bled dry, the Promethean wells stuttering as what had once been twin spears of flame were reduced to flaring bursts. It hardly seemed to matter anymore. Everything around him was a sheet of fire, aliens stumbling and writhing about, blinded by ash and smoke, burning alive in the fury of the Fulminata unleashed. It was like a scene from one of Chaplain Castor's sermons, the coming of the Emperor's righteous judgment, when the heretic and the Xenos would be purged by unending, divine fire. Uxis only wished he had more to give. He slammed his ignited fists forwards, pulverizing an orc's torso as it came charging through the fires, ignited from head to foot. Tyro and Tor were both dead, their gravis plate hacked open, half buried by a mound of orc corpses. Ancient Skyrus had fallen too, still holding his standard aloft, even in death. Extremis was immobilized, one side of its gravlift wrecked by the endless barrage of greenskin rockets and stick grenades. Only Uxis and Captain Demeter still fought. A huge brute of a greenskin hammered two long blades time and again against the captain's gravis armor as Demeter battled to protect the standard of the Fulminata. Uxis was trying to reach the captain's side, but the big orc's kindred were swarming him. Another leapt at the sole surviving aggressor, clutching at him, trying to wrestle him to the ground with a terrible strength. His heavy gauntlet pulverized the skull of another, even as it drove a two-handed chainblade into his midriff. Pain surged as the roaring blades bit deep. A backhand swipe of his gauntlet smashed the orc's head from its shoulders, but it was too late. Another was digging a knife through the armor joints beneath his backpack. He felt his legs growing weak as his Belisarian furnace kicked in, demanding one last bout of slaughter in the name of the chapter and the Primarch. He crushed skulls and broke bones, choking on his own blood, given over to mindless fury now as he sought to kill as many Xenos as he could before they took him. Beyond, he was vaguely aware of the captain. The orc he was fighting had cleaved away one arm with a huge swing of one of its blades, and now it was bellowing with laughter as it stepped away from the crackling arcs of Demeter's Boltstorm gauntlet. It was toying with him. The realization sent a fresh surge of hate jolting through Uxis. He tried once more to reach the captain, but something hammered into his flank, causing him to stumble. A squig had leapt clear through the flames and was now clamping its huge slavering jaws around his right arm, sawing its teeth through ceramite and plasteel. He smashed his other fist into it, causing it to burst in a huge wave of stinking gore and meat, but the effort of the blow forced him to his knees. He could feel his strength ebbing, the pain from his wounds too much to ignore any more. Demeter had fallen as well, his armor buckled in half a dozen places. Uxis saw him framed against the blue and white of the Fulminata's standard, the beastly alien warlord looming over him, burning bodies heaped all about. The captain's blood-splattered white helm turned, and Uxis realized they were looking at each other. Demeter's voice clicked over the vox, somehow still so calm, even at the end. "Courage and honor, brother Uxis." Then the green tide fell upon them both, and they were gone. As suddenly as the vision appeared, it shattered. Polixis's eyes focused again, and his breathing returned. The dead lay before Polixis, silent, the judgment of their glassy helmet lenses damning. "Where were you, brother apothecary? Where were you when we gave our lives that others might live?" Polixis had seen it. In a half-sleep, he had seen Uxis's final moments, and alongside him, those of Captain Demeter. His omophagia, the eighth organ implanted in all space marines, had made sure he was not spared his brother's dying moments. Normally, the implant allowed an Adeptus Astartes to gain a degree of recollection by consuming the flesh of another. Polixis had never heard of it occurring, thanks to the forced consumption of gene seed before. It only added to the horror, choking Polixis as surely as the gland had itself, cold and clammy, like Uxis's death grip from beyond the grave. In the longest, darkest hours of the night, Polixis realized that what little emotions he possessed had been bled dry. The calculating part of his mind told him as much, continuing to narrate his situation in its surgical tone, removed from the reality of his predicament. That reality, he now understood, was that the meaning of his existence had been reduced to nothingness. He had sundered his sacred duty to his chapter and the Imperium. He had failed to protect the lives, bodies, and war gear of those in his charge. Worse than that, he had disgraced them, dishonored them with abject defeat. He was trapped, his soul bound forever to the oblivion of regret, locked in the darkness of a body unable to so much as move a single arm. He would die here, he had no doubt. It would be slow, probably butchery. That knowledge did not concern him. His life was forfeit regardless. He had no means to resist his fate, and thus all other considerations became academical. And then, abruptly, the situation changed. He heard a faint metallic groan. It took a second to draw his thoughts up out of the despair that had nearly drowned them. He realized that his whole body had been tense for hours, and that both his arms were now actively pressing against the metal bent crudely round his wrists. That meant the servos were responding.